Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Wayward Podcast, where the word paves the way. My name is Jonathan Robinson, and I am your host today, and I am here to bring you another episode filled with what I hope is material that is both educational and encouraging. If this is your first time here, I am so glad you're here. I welcome you. And if you like what you hear, I would love it if you subscribed to wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're on the YouTube channel, I'd love it if you liked and subscribed there. And if you are a returning listener, welcome back. I am so glad and thankful for your support. Today, we are continuing on in our Bible story series. As you may or may not know, we have been going through the days of creation in the Genesis 1 story, exploring what functions God gave order to within creation. And if you've been following along up until now, you may recall that the first 3 days are structured as days of forming, days in which God forms a specific function within existence. On day one, we explored the function of time being given formation. On day two, we observed the function of weather being established. And on day three, the waters were separated and the lands emerged and the soil enabled the life cycle of vegetation to commence. And if you haven't listened to any of those episodes, I really encourage you to go back and check them out. But at the end of the first 3 days, we then came to the second set of 3 days. And these 3 days, the second set of 3 days, is structured as days of filling. The first 3 days of formation, they set the stage for what the second set of 3 days would fill. The functions established in these first 3 days, they form the basis that sustains what the next 3 days will bring forth. So there is parallelism and correlation going on between the first set of 3 days and the second set of 3 days. For example, what was formed on day one sets up what is filled on day four. On day one, God established time, but then on day four, God appointed the lights in the sky to act as functionaries of time, allowing for time to be measured and discerned. So again, the functions established in the first 3 days form the basis for what the next 3 days will fill. So with that understanding in mind, we will now explore what God fills creation with on day five. Okay? But of course, that means quickly reviewing what function was formed on day two. So if you recall from a few episodes ago, on day two, God established the function of weather. And that function was established through the separating of the waters above from the waters below by means of the dome that is called the sky. And the weather taking place in the sky determines the amount of rain that falls upon the world below. But weather is not the only activity that is set up to take place within this expanded separation of sky and sea. The vast expanse and emptiness also anticipates what day five is about to fill it with. So if you have your Bibles and you want to follow along, I am going to be reading from Genesis chapter 1, verses 20 through 23. So here we go. Verse 20. And God said, "Let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky." So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, of every kind, with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. Now, I have been repeatedly citing this source in previous episodes, in which I will do so again here. Dr. John Walton's writings and thoughts on Genesis 1 have really been invaluable to me throughout the study. He has really helped significantly expand my understanding of the creation text. And I just want to encourage you, if you really get into that kind of material, I really encourage you to check out his stuff as well. And regarding this day five here, Walton identifies a significant difference. He writes, in contrast to day four, where the functionaries were helping to accomplish the functions associated with the sphere which they inhabited, in day five, the functionaries simply carry out their own functions in the cosmic space that they inhabit. Okay? So in other words, whereas the lights in day four helped to accomplish the function of time by acting as signs of the seasons and passing periods, the flying and swimming functionaries of this day five do not help the sky or sea accomplish their functions, but rather simply carry out their own functions amidst the skies and seas where they dwell. Okay? Now, one question that we might ask here is, what is the difference between the functionary of day four and the flying and swimming functionaries of day five? Well, in the text for day four, the language really doesn't convey any information that specifically describes the nature of the lights in the sky. In fact, the language is left deliberately vague in order to avoid any cultural merging of the lights with the other gods or deities of the land. So while the language has little to say about the lights, one thing that is pretty heavily implied is that the lights are without personality. Whatever the lights are, they are not living beings. And that, I believe, is the primary difference between the functionary of day four and the functionaries of day five. Because in day five, the functionaries that emerge in the text are very much living beings. The text calls them living creatures to populate both the skies and the seas. Every winged bird of every kind to fill and soar the skies. Every living creature of every kind to fill and swim the seas. But another question that we might ask here is, if their living quality is the one difference between them and the functionary of day four, then how exactly does living or simply existing distinguish their functionary role in the skies and seas? And the answer, I believe, is that their functionary role is not distinguished by their mere existence, but by God's blessing. Doubling down on their mere existence in verse 22, we read in the text, God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. So it is in God's blessing that a function is appointed to them, to be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and sky and earth. Now, here for the first time in the scriptural story, we encounter an important word that will not only shape the story going forward, but will periodically reappear to keep shaping the story and give the story dimension and characterization. It is the word bless. What does bless mean? This is an idea that I have wrestled with and struggled to understand for a while, but based on my own research and understanding, here's where I'm at with it now. The Hebrew word for bless is closely related to the Hebrew word for knee. And if I understand it correctly, the Israelites viewed the knees as a source or a place of one's strength. Okay? And one of the other meanings that is associated with the Hebrew word bless is to kneel. So the imagery I'm picking up from this is that to bless may have involved an act of kneeling. And if knees are seen as the source or place of one's strength, then the act of blessing may also involve the offering up or the conferring of one's strength to another, which may be done in a variety of ways, I guess, because, you know, when you look through the scriptural story, you see blessing taking form in all kinds of different ways. So that's just my attempt to wrestle with the possible meanings and imagery that may be going on in the word bless. But what might all of that mean for this particular moment in verse 22? And how does God's blessing distinguish these birds and sea creatures' existence? So it is possibly one of the most, I think, it is possibly one of the most intimate depictions of God since the sweeping presence in verse 2. Like, up until now, God is depicted as a wind sweeping over the vastness of creation, speaking its functions into formation. But now, perhaps the language of blessing here depicts God as becoming more intimate with these creatures, these birds and sea creatures that have just appeared. And by intimate, I mean perhaps the usage of God's blessing here depicts an imagery of God kneeling before the prospect of birds and sea creatures, not as an act of worship, but as an act of conferring special strength upon them. It's almost kind of like the same image of a grandfather or a father, really, just kind of kneeling down in front of their child and placing his hands on their shoulders in order to confer upon them something significant, you know, a piece of knowledge or wisdom. And so, so as it seems here that this is like a moment where God confers special strength upon them. A conferring strength that acknowledges their existence in the skies and seas. A conferring strength that affirms their uniqueness amidst creation's functionaries. And a conferring strength that appoints to them a function that they are to carry out. But however we might describe what exactly blessing is, the text shows us that it was God's purposeful pronouncement upon these birds and sea creatures that bestowed on them the status of being blessed. And that privileged status is a development that takes this creation story to another level, because up until now, the creation story has been about ensuring the environment is ready to support and sustain life. And thus far, the creation story has been pulsating with an anticipation that something special will emerge in this world and fill it with God's creative wonder. And now here on day 5, we are introduced to those first wonders, birds and sea creatures. And now that they're here, what do they add to this story? I'm going to go off a thought here that John Walton briefly shared about the great sea monsters that are seen in verse 21. Walton comments that in ancient times there were great sea creatures that were viewed as threats, or they were viewed as what you might call the living manifestation of chaos. And Walton makes the comment that their appearance here in the text renders the great sea monsters as living creatures that are not a part of the chaos, but rather as God's creation, are part of the order that God is bringing to creation. I remember in the episode that when we were discussing day two, that familiar phrase that appears all throughout the creation story, that God saw that it was good, that phrase was absent from the discussion on day two about the waters below. And I remember suggesting that it's possible that that good description, that, you know, God saw that it was good, it is possible that good description is missing because the ancient peoples did not often view the seas as good places, but rather as tumultuous environments of chaos. So the absence of the good description kind of creates what feels like a plot hole for day two. However, now, with the appearance of the sea creatures on day five, and this time with the text including the good description, perhaps that helps to distinguish what these creatures bring to the story. Meaning that these sea creatures, they function as living demonstrations of God's goodness at work in creation, particularly in the environments most often associated with chaos. In other words, whereas many ancient peoples might look at the seas and see just chaos, the day five text might teach the Israelite audience to look at the same seas and consider how the great sea monsters might be functionaries that indicate the orderliness and design God has brought to the seas. And just kind of thinking on that, it kind of reminds me of the first time that when I was a little kid, my parents took my sister and I to Florida for a wonderful trip. And we went to Disney World and everything. And then we went up to Daytona Beach, Florida. And that was my very first time seeing the Atlantic Ocean. And, you know, kind of bending down there and, you know, tasting the salt of the ocean. And just, you know, it felt, I mean, as a kid who was growing up in, you know, around the Great Lakes of Michigan, you could feel the difference in the water. You know, it was like, I know what Lake Superior and Lake Michigan felt like, but this ocean, it felt different. You know, there was, I think you know what I mean, but I remember standing there on the beach with my parents and looking as far as I could see, you know, which, you know, it's an ocean, it's the Atlantic Ocean, so it just kind of trails off into the, you know, into the horizon. But I remember on that beach, I remember that one of the first thoughts I had was, somewhere out there, the Titanic is lying 2.5 miles below the surface. I enjoyed reading about the Titanic of the kids. Let me rephrase that. I enjoyed reading about the Titanic as a kid. And so I kind of had those things in my mind. But that was my first thought, and it was kind of that kind of thought. It's kind of reflective of the chaos that one can expect from the seas. You know, you can expect shipwrecks and such. But I also remember my next thoughts after that were about all the great white sharks. You know, like I grew up watching Jaws and, you know, Free Willy and everything, but, you know, the great white sharks and the orca whales and the giant squid and possibly even jellyfish, you know, I was just thinking about all that out there. And that thought just kind of got me thinking, whoa, cool. So yes, there is chaos out there in the seas, but there are also magnificent living signs of order swimming around those ocean depths with majesty and beauty embedded into their design. And perhaps the same thought here could also be applied to the activity that is going on in the sky. When we discussed day two, we looked at how the function of weather was established to curb the chaos of flooding by regulating the rains. But one of the realities that we had to accept is that, yes, sometimes even regulated rainfall can cause chaos upon the earth. But what if, like these great sea monsters, what if, like I said, with the sea monsters swimming mightily against the chaos of the waters, what if the birds of the sky also act like functionaries that soar against the chaos that sometimes goes on in the sky? When the weather forms, storms that send rains flooding down and great winds, the chaos can create a question about God's presence or God's goodness, you know? But what if the sight of an eagle soaring calmly in the sky is intended as a functionary sign that life God has designed abides unbothered amidst that chaos? In Psalm 104, verses 3 through 4, the psalmist is praising God, and the psalmist says of God in verse 3 and 4, "You set the beams of your chambers on the waters. You make the clouds your chariot. You ride on the wings of the wind. You make the wings your messengers. Fire and flame your ministers." And the imagery there is that the winds act as God's messengers. But wind, as we know, is invisible. But what's not invisible are the birds that dance upon those winds. So while the winds are God's messengers in this imagery, perhaps it's the birds on the wind that demonstrate or act out the message that the chaos in the sky is joined by a sense of order manifested in the designed winged majesty. And, you know, just kind of a side story, you know, my dad and I, in the last few months, one of the things that we've really begun to enjoy is going to different nature spots around town and watching birds, watching eagles fly, you know, like during migration periods. And, you know, some of these days, you know, we will, you know, kind of, we've still been in winter here. And even though it is the first day of spring, I think, you know, there's still some wintry cold winds kind of blowing back and forth. And so you kind of step out there and, you know, you're feeling the wind just blow against you and it's kind of cold. And it's just, you know, you see the branches kind of shaking and everything and the water's just kind of, you know, whipping around and everything. And it's just like, you know. But then we look up into the sky and we see eagles with wings spread out, effortlessly ascending higher and higher, circling over the area, watching everything. And that imagery and this text kind of helps, I wonder, I think, helps convey the truth that God is at work in creation. And I think that is what what Israel was supposed to take away and what we are supposed to take away from this day five text where life emerges for the first time. Life that lives against the chaos. And that's only the beginning. That's only the beginning of the life that God is going to create. And so, we're going to conclude it there. I hope that this material has been educational, encouraging. I hope that it blesses you today. I hope that through this material, I hope that God confers his strength to you today. So I thank you so very much for listening in. You'd have a great day, okay? Thank you for joining me here at the Wayward Podcast, where the word paves the way.
This is my story. This is my song. Praising my Savior all the day long. This is my story. This is my song. Praising my Savior.